Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I'm pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author David Bernstein. David wears many hats. He's a writer, he's a filmmaker, a commentator, a consultant, and much more. And it would seem that it's kind of hard to pin down all the different things that he does, but what it is that all of his work focuses on his passion and supports his passion for speaking out for the millennial generation. And that is what he is here for tonight, to talk about his new book, Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. So if you would please join me in giving a warm welcome to David Bernstein.
Thank you. Thanks for that. And thank you all for coming out. So this is Fast Future, and I've been on book tour with it. It came out on the 12th, and I've been, this is my fifth city so far since then doing it. And I just want to talk a little bit about the book, sort of why I wrote it, sort of what you can find in it, and then really, you know, open it up to questions and hear what you think. Just by a show of hands, who here has a millennial person in their life? Who here has to deal with people in this generation on a regular basis? Okay, so that's why I wrote the book, because I feel that, you know, this is a generation that in a lot of ways is misunderstood, and I believe that there's great power as a young person in telling the story of a generation, and that people in that generation deserve to have a voice in the debate to define what a generation is. So I started out in the 2008 election cycle. I made a documentary film called 18 and 08 about youth engagement in politics, and we took the film all over the country and did about 1,000 events between 2007 and 2008, and registered over 25,000 new voters. And sort of as the campaign was coming to a close, one of the things that I found really interesting was we went to college campuses and we were talking to young people. I did 23 states between September and November of 2008. And I found it fascinating that people were not only interested in, you know, voting and wanting to participate in the election, which they very much wanted to do and they very much did, but that there was also a sense of wanting to have some deeper commitment and engagement with the world. They were, people were saying, you know, I want to vote, I'm going to vote, but also my friends and I are really concerned about the environment, and we're getting together after we graduate to start a green energy company to do something about the problem. Or people who are saying, you know, I'm going to Africa because I've heard about, you know, I've been studying African studies and I'm concerned about the problems there and I'm going there. So there was a lot of this kind of stuff, and I said, that doesn't seem to me to be normal. That doesn't seem to be what people in this youth cohort have always done. So at the same time, I was reading all these articles and books with titles such as The Dumbest Generation, or there's a book called Is This Generation the Worst Generation of Employees in History, and all this stuff. And you know, this was not what I was seeing. This was not my experience. And incidentally, all these books were, perhaps not surprisingly, written by people outside of the generation. And I'd seen in the election cycle, you know, the success we had with giving young voters a voice. I'd gone on television, on CNN and NPR and ABC, and, you know, to talk about the role young voters were playing and really try and put a face on the movement. And there were a lot of young people who were doing that. And I think that part of that helped give people a connection other than just someone saying, you know, young people are really going to turn out this time. And everybody sort of said, yeah, right. You know, everybody says that every time around. And so I had an appreciation for the power and the importance of storytelling and the importance of sort of putting something together in a narrative form to help communicate a message. So I set out to write this book. And one thing I should say at the outset, which I sort of have to say because it's one of the first, otherwise it's one of the first questions I get, and I think it colors people's perspective. You know, what I've written in this book is not by any means an account of every single person in this generation. This is a generation of 80 million people. It's the largest generation in history. And I think that one of the most, you know, important things that we have to remember when we talk about generations and we talk about, you know, any large group of people is that in any generation you can find people who fit any stereotype that you would like. You can find lazy people. You can find, you know, crazy people. You can find, you know, people who are sitting on their couch eating potato chips. And you can also find people who are altruistic and idealistic and doing great work and starting businesses. And what I've tried to do, and I think anyone who writes about a group of people tries to do, is to point out what are the most exciting and important trends in a generation and ones that are affecting other people, that are affecting the rest of our world, that we should be paying attention to, that are in some way unique from what's happened before. So please take everything I say with that in mind. You know, this is a generation that came of age around the time of 9/11. This is a generation that came of age around the time of Columbine, which of course happened not too far from here. This is a generation that came of age with seeing the first wave of financial scandals with Enron and WorldCom and Tyco, the impeachment of Bill Clinton and the scandal surrounding that. So these are sort of, just to give you a sense of some of the experiences that have helped color this generation's formative years. Pretty impactful set of experiences that have colored our opinions about politics. We've seen, you know, we saw politics as an imperfect system. We didn't view politicians growing up as heroes or as, you know, crusaders fighting for justice. We viewed it as a sort of workaday process that was full of imperfections. We didn't have the most positive view of business and growing up, even just seeing, you know, some of those first scandals. We, you know, had this sort of incredible fear put into us with Columbine and 9/11. But both of those incidents could have resulted in this generation saying, you know, we're afraid, we're going to close ourselves off, we're going to, you know, hide, we're not going to engage. And instead, they've made this generation resilient, and they've made this generation want to go out and do something about the problems in the world. You know, they've made this generation understand and appreciate the deep interconnected nature of our world, that we're a global world. This is the first global generation. You know, this generation is one that realizes that we have a deep connection to our peers all over the world, and the accessibility, the fact that we believe we can be in touch with anyone in the world with just one click. And even if we're not doing that, the possibility and the knowledge of that means that we can't ignore the fact that we live in a global world. There was a study that just came out yesterday, actually, which I thought was really interesting about, it was a global study of youth opinions on gay marriage. And it showed that 68% of American millennials support, you know, were in support of gay marriage. And in China, surprisingly, that number was 62%. So it's also a generation which shares global values, even in places where, you know, we might not expect there to be a culture around, you know, social openness and social justice and some of these issues. So I think that's important to point out. There's much more connectivity and awareness of the fact that we have peers working on the issues that we care about all over the world. So there are a couple points that I want to make, and one is sort of about the impact of the recession and what it's done to this generation, and actually sort of what I would describe as sort of the silver lining of this crisis. So this generation, you know, came of, you know, as soon as we got out of school or as soon as we sort of began to enter the workforce, obviously we were hit with this terrible recession. Youth unemployment has been, you know, skyrocketed throughout this entire period. And what I found particularly interesting in this experience of talking to young people who have been affected by the recession is that people are not despondent and they're not depressed, and they realize that if they don't have a job at the moment, that there's a very good chance that they will have one in the future. And, you know, part of what's happening is there's a sense that people have to do more with less. There's a sense of entrepreneurialism. There's a sense of, you know, okay, well, we grew up in this world, you know, with this idea that we were living in this incredibly prosperous time, that there was all this opportunity, there were all these great things for us to do, and now that's not the reality. So as opposed to sort of complaining, millennials have gone out there and they've created their own opportunity. We've seen a huge spike in entrepreneurship. 15% of people right out of college today are starting businesses, which is up 300% from where it was just 20 years ago. And, you know, I called the book Fast Future because that's sort of the best way I sort of could come up with to conceive of the frame of this particular era, where we're moving so fast into the future that we can't necessarily see where the line is between the future and the present. And for people of other generations, this is something that is often incredibly overwhelming because all these things are changing so fast, and how do we adapt? And we just, you know, we're a business and we just figured out how we were going to adapt to this, and then, but now something else has happened. Now we have to adapt to that. And it's a constant pace of having to keep up with that. But the millennials are not only comfortable in that world, they're thriving in it because we're the people who have actually created that reality by creating platforms and tools and sort of writing the operating system, if you will, the new operating system of the 21st century. And as a result, we know how to best influence and operate in it. So when you look at something like the recession, you know, and you compare it to, say, the Great Depression, in that time period, there was this sense that we have no, you know, there was no sense of optimism. The whole, you know, country was consumed by that experience. All the culture, you know, the music, the, you know, everything, every street corner, you know, exuded that spirit of depression and that. And no one had a sense that, you know, this will figure itself out somehow in a year or two, you know. And this generation, because we've seen how much things can change so fast, we have an understanding that's led to an incredible amount of optimism. So at the peak of the economic crisis, 80% of millennials actually said that they believed that they would have enough money to live the life they wanted to live in the future. They didn't say they had the money they wanted at that particular moment, but they remain optimistic and they remain confident about that. And I don't think it's a bad bet because we've seen how much can happen in 1 year. I mean, we've had, you know, 2 years ago, we had a year where at the beginning of the year, we, you know, no one, you know, people thought that Twitter was something a bird did. And then by the end of the year, it was taking down dictators. So I think that's a great illustration of how fast things can move and how fast things that may initially seem harmless or inane can turn into powerful tools of social change and movements. One other thing to say about the economic picture, which is that last week there was a great study that came out about how this generation is actually shedding its debt faster than many other previous youth demographics. And the reason for that is kind of surprising, which is that millennials have the lowest rates of home ownership, car ownership, and marriage of almost any youth demographic. So they're not taking on the debt that young people typically take on at a young age to buy those kind of things. They do have student loan debt, but the assumption of people having enough money and this is all built around the idea that people before they turn, around the time they turn 30, are going to get married, they're going to be owning cars, and they're going to be owning homes. So that is no longer true. I spoke earlier today at University of Denver, and we had this. I spoke to a class, and I had everyone do a little poll that I've done a couple places, and I asked everyone to raise their hand who if they thought that owning a home was something that was really important to them. It was a big life goal. And I think there were maybe four or five people who raised their hands. And I asked everyone if, you know, they thought that being part of a community, the people and friends and, you know, having that was an important piece of their life. And everyone raised their hands. And then I asked if, you know, how people felt, if they felt that getting married was something that was really important to them, was a big focus in their life. I think maybe like two or three people raised their hands. And then I asked everyone if finding someone they love and someone they care about was important to them, and everyone raised their hand. So I think that's a great illustration of the shift in what the American experience is meaning in this generation, and it's also shifting the economy. And it's something that we're going to have to think a lot about over the next, you know, several decades as, you know, inevitably more people will end up buying homes and getting married. But those levels may not return to the levels we're used to. And it's to me, it's encouraging because it's a redefining of institutions that's really a shift in values away from thinking that owning a piece of land just means that you're part of a community, that you can find your own community, that you can be part of different communities, and a shift away from, you know, marriage as an institution and more towards love and finding companionship. And I think that those are some of the promising trends to me in this generation. And one of the other things that I am particularly encouraged by, as I mentioned before, is this idea of entrepreneurialism. So this is a really incredible generation of entrepreneurs. There are more people starting businesses and organizations today than almost ever before. The ability and the process to do that, the sense of agency that young people have in this particular world, the process has now been demystified. We, you know, the people think, hey, I could do that. I could start something. And that's really pushed down the power away from, you know, people having to go work for big institutions and being able to do their own work. You know, 10 years ago, if you were a young person, you wanted to go, you know, do something great in the world and help people overseas, you had a limited set of options. You could maybe go work for an organization like Amnesty International or the Red Cross, or you could go work for the Peace Corps. Yeah, but the idea that you could go create your own initiative directly and just, you know, get a little bit of money and go over to Africa or to India and set up a shop and start having impact was totally, totally foreign concept. But nobody, you know, I mean, there were a handful of people who were doing it, but there was in no way was that mainstream. Now there are young people who are, you know, starting that journey, you know, every week in some different way. And incidentally, I might add that organizations like Amnesty International are now in a challenging spot because the young people who want to come work there, what they can offer them, because they're now such, you know, these organizations are now such big and so institutional, is a job as a development associate or as a, you know, a desk assistant or something like that, where they can't see the impact and the movement that they want to be part of. So we're seeing this shift towards project-based problem solving. You know, Nicholas Kristof wrote about this and called it the DIY foreign aid revolution. So this idea that you can go and you can help a small community and bite off a small piece of the problem as in a way that foreign aid was typically designed to do, but now through all the bureaucracy and all the processing of it, it's not really ever getting to actually fund a specific community. I tell a great story in the book about a girl from New Jersey who graduated from high school, went on a trip to Nepal, you know, met all these orphans in the street, was incredibly affected by her experience, called her parents and asked them to wire her entire life savings, which wasn't very much. And she started a orphanage for these children and then built a school. Didn't have no experience in how to run a school or how to run an orphanage, but just was driven by this incredible passion and said, I have to do something about this. And she now is the legal guardian of 50 orphans in Nepal and has been recognized the world over for her incredible work. And, you know, they just broke ground. They just brought in a principal for their school, and they have an entire school in operation there. And I think, you know, that is something that no sort of foreign aid line item in a budget could do at this point. There's not that sense of creativity and that sense of can-do spirit in that system. So, and for Maggie, the girl I'm talking about, it's an incredible experience, and she can see the impact she's having, and she's having that tremendous impact. So I think that's, you know, stories like that, you know, more of which are in the book, are part of what's incredibly encouraging to me. I think the other piece that I'm particularly excited about is sort of the growth of sort of businesses, and in the same way that there are these sort of small pockets of social entrepreneurs who are addressing these problems, there are also businesses who are moving on, you know, smaller kind of projects that may, you know, in the long run add up to bigger institutions. If you think about companies that this generation has created, you know, Facebook being an interesting example, you know, Facebook only employs under 5,000 people. And, you know, this is at scale. This is as a, you know, publicly traded company, arguably one of the most, you know, important companies created in the 21st century. So that's a real shift. If, you know, as more businesses grow to scale, they're leaner than businesses have been in the past. And so you're seeing more and more small businesses and smaller enterprises that millennials are starting that in aggregate will make up for those jobs, but may individually only ever employ at most, you know, 5,000 people, and more likely for a good duration of their lifespan will employ 100 people or 200 people. So that's a shift in that piece of it. The last part I want to talk about is sort of activism. So I write in the book about a concept called pragmatic idealism, which is sort of how I define this, the sort of the governing theory of social change in this generation. I talk a lot about, you know, the 1960s and the way that the boomer generation helped, you know, engender a spirit of activism and responsibility in people in this generation as parents, and how that legacy has transformed. So one of the things, and you know, my parents were both activists in the 1960s, and, you know, I think, and I've spent a lot of time trying to understand, you know, why the activism in that time period was so successful. And, you know, one of the things I think was incredibly powerful is that there was incredible deep personal visceral meaning of the injustice in the time period on civil rights in Vietnam. And people felt that, you know, that there was this very clear injustice, there were these very clear wrong things, and people wanted to go do something about them. And they sparked outrage. They were the kind of things, the kind of injustices that generate real outrage, that generate people in the streets. And people mobilized, and the Civil Rights Act was passed, and the Vietnam War was ended, and that legacy, you know, lives on today. But as a result of that, as a result of the focus being so specific on those two things, a lot of people in that generation then went back to, you know, whatever other parts of their lives doing. They said, this is what we fought for. This is what we wanted, and we got it. That's not to say that many didn't also stay on and continue doing that work. But by and large, those were what people set out to do, and that was the big success, and people moved on. This generation has a little bit of a different approach. You know, first of all, the activist spirit or the socially minded spirit doesn't arise out of any specific clear injustice. I think if we look at the world today, there are lots of problems, there are lots of injustices, but I think it's difficult at this particular moment to pick out what the two, you know, clearest injustices that everybody in this country could absolutely agree are the two most important battles to be fighting are. And I think as a result, you've seen a diffusion in the kind of work that people are doing. And people say, I'm passionate about, you know, about education, so I'm going to take my energy and I'm going to put it towards that. I'm passionate about, you know, women's rights. I'm going to take my energy and put it towards that. And so there aren't a million people marching in the street. You know, incidentally, you know, there's a criticism that I think a lot of people don't see the activism in this generation. In the March on Washington, when a million people went down to March on Washington, nobody had ever done that before. That's part of the reason that it had such a great impact. And since then, there have been a million people marching on Washington for just about everything you could possibly imagine. So, when congressmen were walking around Washington, D.C., they were walking to work, and they're looking, oh my God, there's a mob out here that is demanding action on something. This must really be serious. And that had a real impact. Today, congressmen walk by the mall and see people protesting it barely has an effect on that. And I think people in this generation realize that protest and sort of particularly mass protest just doesn't carry the same weight that it once did. And so people don't spend a lot of time doing it. But as a result, we sort of then get this bad rap for being apathetic and not activists because people can't see the activism we're doing. So what are sort of the other forms of it? So one is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, people who are going into, you know, sort of socially minded business to try and address problems. So you've seen actually a huge rise in young people who are starting alternative energy and green energy companies and initiatives because they say, okay, this is something I care about. This is something that's important to me. And climate change is a huge issue in this generation. But I don't think it's that effective to go, you know, down to Washington and lobby for more money and more action because we've been doing that for a long time. And clearly it's not getting that far. So why don't I go be part of the solution instead of just sort of, activating for action on the problem? I can actually solve something. So you're seeing a lot of that. You're seeing people trying to find ways to actually create solution-based projects that help push forward the ultimate goal. You're also seeing young people working with businesses to try and, you know, make them more socially minded and socially responsible. You know, some of the work that young people have done to try and get Walmart to change some of its practices has been successful, whatever you may want to think about that company. The fact that, you know, young people in large part and other consumers said, you know, we care about the environment and they reduced their carbon emissions by a great deal. You know, if you're concerned about the amount of carbon that's going into the atmosphere that we all know is one of the leading causes of hurting our environment, you can't sort of say, well, it doesn't matter that one of the largest employers in the United States dramatically reduces their carbon emission. And I think people in this generation believe that you have to work with all actors who are willing to come to the table, whether they're businesses, whether you disagree with some of the things they do, whether they're, you know, politicians who, you know, you don't think have all the right interests at heart. We want to bring all these people together because we're by and large focused on trying to see solutions and trying to achieve progress. The third thing I'll sort of point out about activism, which I think people misunderstand the activism in this generation as sort of it's labeled by some as slacktivism or this idea that people are just pressing, you know, buttons online to, you know, to do something and they think by liking something on Facebook that they're changing the world. I'll first tell you from my personal experience that nobody who sends out a tweet or likes something on Facebook thinks they've just contributed this great act to saving humanity. That's not the case. But what I think is important to note is that, first of all, more young people are philanthropists than ever before. In 2011, 75% of millennials gave money to a philanthropic cause. What's interesting about that is that everything we know about how people develop and how we form our habits suggests that, things that we do when we're younger then translate into behaviors we repeat as we get older. So if you're having 75% of people in this generation make their first donation, even if it's $5, even if they gave it because they could send it via text message, that it flies in the face of everything we understand about how people develop to say that these people aren't going to continue to be philanthropists as they grow up. So we've increased the amount of exposure they're getting to that by practicing and modeling that behavior. And one can only hope that that will grow as this generation gets older. The same is also could also be said about awareness of social issues. When you press that button to like the organization or the cause or the issue on Facebook, you're now subscribing to get information about what's going on with that for as long as you decide to get that information. So now into your daily life, as you read about what's going on with your friends, you're getting information about what's happening in the Eastern Congo, or what's happening in the education reform movement. And more people today are aware of those things, and the awareness is more widespread than ever before. That's a great thing. Everything that we know would suggest that if people are introduced to concepts of social change and social justice and these causes early in their lifetime, that some of them, as they get older, will incorporate more of that into their life, and some won't, and that's fine. But I think we should keep in mind the perspective here that there is more access to this information, there's more awareness, and there's more possibility today than there has been in the past. And, who says that everybody needs to be a super activist at age 24? And we do have a lot of them. And I think that, it's important to put that in perspective and remember that, because it's a big change, and it's, I think, going to have an increasing impact. The idea that people, it's now fashionable. It's now, it's not used to be that people who went to go do charity work or good work were somehow perceived as, not as cool as the people who were going into finance and the people who were, going into that kind of, and I would say that those roles have now reversed in terms of what is considered, what is considered a good thing to do and what's fashionable and what people are responding to. Suddenly, being socially minded, and so, one of the people I profiled for the book is Lauren Bush Lauren, who is the granddaughter of George H.W. Bush, and she was a model and, went to Princeton and was very interested in fashion, and then, had this experience seeing, going abroad with a UN trip and seeing, hunger and seeing all these things, and said, I'm going to create a fashion line of bags called Feed Bags, of which all the money goes to the World Food Program. And she's been very successful with it. People wear these bags all over the place, and she has hats, and she has a whole line of products. And it's now cool to wear a product that's saying, I support, world hunger, and people are finding ways, or ending world hunger, I should say. People are finding ways to merge that. And you're seeing a lot of that in fashion. You're seeing a lot of that in food. In sort of the ways that people express who they are. So that's a little bit about this generation. And as you can see, I'm incredibly optimistic about this generation. And I think there's a lot of possibility. I think that it's important to have this conversation. I also just want to point out Eric Glustrom, who walked in, who is a dear friend of mine and is featured in the book. Eric runs an organization called Educate, which does some incredible work in Uganda. And maybe Eric will grace us with a few words later on about what he does. But Eric is a great example of people in this generation who, are going, who Eric didn't know how to navigate the government bureaucracy of Uganda when he went over there. How old were you? You were 16 when you first went over there? 17. So, Eric believed as any 17-year-old would that he could go over to Uganda and do something. And, you know, he's had a tremendous impact. And now they're the program that they've developed to train young people in Uganda in how to be social entrepreneurs and create a spirit of activism and education there has actually been adopted nationwide by the Ugandan government. And it's a really incredible thing. And I could be here all night telling you stories like that. I will end there, and thank you very much, and I'll be happy to take questions. Yeah.
Two questions. I'm curious about how the millennials see Generation X. Mm. And the second question is, every generation has a perception in the popular press, but in reality, there's fissures and disagreements within them. Not everybody was a hippie
right.
in the 1960s. And that's kind of just the myth that we
yep.
have of that
yep.
late 60s generation. What are the fissures within the millennials?
So I'll answer the second one first and try and incorporate the first one into the second, and if I don't, I'll come back to it. So it's a good point, and you know, as I said, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, every generation, like it or not, gets defined, and this is something that, you know, I go back and forth on, because, you know, I sort of believe that it's important to try and define a generation in the moment as it's experiencing it. And then if I'm totally wrong, you know, 5 years from now, I'll write another book and I'll update you. But, you know, I think that there's something important about understanding it in the context of the time, because one thing that's really interesting, you go back and look at every generation. So initially, you know, for a period of time, the Great Depression generation was, during the 1960s, viewed very negatively as, you know, people who were standing on the sidelines of all these, you know, battles that were being fought on civil rights and Vietnam, and that, you know, they were not by and large engaged in that. Some of them were. And then Tom Brokaw came out and wrote a book calling them the Greatest Generation. And then, you know, that became the default perception. The 60s, you know, generation during the 1960s was viewed as this incredible generation of rabble-rousing, you know, activists. And then in the 70s, you know, Tom Wolfe coined them the Me Generation. And they got this other reputation. And then in a lot of ways, they've been rehabilitated as the, you know, millennials have gotten the reputation of being the Me Generation. So there have actually been multiple generations who have been described in the exact same way at different points in their trajectory. And it's amazing that as we go through time, we totally change how we talk about these generations. And for a generation, it's a fight, because, you know, there's a sense that feels like, you know, if people view you and view everyone in your generation a certain way, it affects what you're able to do. It affects, you know, the kind of opportunities you're able to have to some degree. The perception, you know, if you want to advance things, I mean, you know, people on Capitol Hill, for instance, I don't think take this generation seriously enough. And as a result, I think that has hurt the ability for this generation to have a voice. You know, there are very few people, you know, they meet constantly with people from all sorts of interest groups, but very rarely with young people. Although yesterday, actually, the House Republicans met with a group of young millennials who were interested in deficit issues, which is like the first time that it happened in years that actually was a high profile meeting with members of Congress and people in this generation. So there is that fight to define it. But to answer your question, you know, I think what I'm talking about, I think, is sort of the dominant trend that's most worth thinking about. But I think there are definitely some people who, you know, not everyone in this generation wants to change the world. But I think that by and large, there are perhaps fewer people in this generation than any other generation before whose sole goal is to make money in life. And that's all they want to do. They just want to make as much money as possible. And, you know, that isn't to say there aren't people who have that viewpoint. But I think that that way of thinking has changed, and people feel like they should, by and large, they should try and do something. So there's that piece of it. And I think it's also worth noting that it's never been more possible for, you know, the, you know, 2% or the 5% of people who are engaged in this kind of activity, in this kind of, you know, socially minded activity, to have more influence on the additional, you know, 95% of people who are out there. The ability for a message to, you know, broadcast and share down and trickle down and have that impact to other people. You know, if you're friends with me on Facebook, you're going to know about what I'm doing, and maybe someday you'll read something that I posted, maybe you won't, and that'll have some kind of, you know, impact. It'll make you think about something. And I periodically get messages from, like, very unsuspecting friends of mine that I went to high school with who, like, you know, saw something and say, like, you know, what you say something to me about that. And I think that's sort of a, you know, it's an interesting example of what's happening, because people are able, no one is sort of just going off and then having no connection. We're constantly connected to people who were in our lives, even if they're not in our lives anymore, and what we're doing is trickling down. But sorry. I think the biggest sort of challenge is about, you know, how do we get to a place where, you know, we have a more sustainable political system? I don't know that it's like a screaming match. I don't know that would be the right way to characterize it, but I think that's perhaps the place where there's the most diversity of opinions. You know, not necessarily politically so much as I think there's a lot of different people have different priorities, which are all, you know, in theory, good ideas. You know, but some people think the way to move forward is to opt out of the political process and, you know, work on our own. Some people think we need to be, you know, engaging more deeply with the political process, and we need to be, you know, activating towards that. Some people think we need to be, you know, focusing on education and changing our education system. Some people think we need to be focusing on changing our economic, you know, system. Some people think we need to be more focused on, you know, how we change, you know, addressing fiscal, long-term fiscal issues. And there are people who share all those beliefs at the same time. So I think that's sort of the biggest question. And it goes to sort of what I said earlier about diffusion and what is going to be the biggest, you know, what's the number one priority? And I don't know that you can say that. People ask, they're like, what's the number one issue for people in this generation? And it's, you know, like people of any generation, there's not one issue that everybody is thinking about. It's pretty all-encompassing. And your question about Generation X, so this is, you know, I wouldn't say that millennials think about other generations as, you know, well, anyone in this generation I don't like or do like. I think that Generation X has a particularly hostile relationship with millennials, because a lot of them are, direct supervisors or employers of people in this generation. And this generation views work differently. The average person in this generation will have 12 jobs at the time they turn 38. People view, you know, my grandmother worked at AT&T for 50 years. She never stopped to say, gee, is the work I'm doing meaningful? Is it fulfilling in my life? And now that's what people want out of their careers. They want it to mean something. They want to be somehow fulfilled. And they want to play a role in the work they're doing. They want to be able to offer ideas and play a part in what they're doing, which is, you know, so, you know, an employer says, just come and shut up and, you know, and do the work. This is the way we've always done it. And I think there's, you know, I understand their perspective, but I also think there's a middle ground, because I think there are things that, you know, new perspectives and new ways of thinking that this generation can offer, especially in a world where this demographic is so large and everything in terms of any kind of consumer industry, any kind of consumer company or service industry, it has to, you know, figure out how to attract this generation. People would, you know, employers would be wise to incorporate and listen to, you know, the people who are their customers in almost every industry, and their most important customers, in the process of doing that. I think there's also a sense of, you know, every new generation of employees brings about new challenges, or any demographic of employees brings about challenges to manage. And, you know, why should learning how to manage this generation be any different than the process people have to go through to learn how to manage people of other generations or other demographics?
Yeah. So it seems that millennials have kind of a idea that I can change the world, whether it be through entrepreneurship or social change or however they decide to go about this. Is that a disadvantage at some point to think I can do this? Like, you're walking into a work environment and you're saying, wow, I don't like the way this is functioning, I'm out, instead of trying to integrate yourself into maybe a society that's already functioning in a certain way. Is that a sort of disadvantage?
So I would actually say that what you're talking about is perhaps the biggest challenge that this generation faces. So this sense that, you know, I think, first of all, it's a great thing that people believe, you know, that they have the power to go out and the agency to believe they can go out and do something, that Eric believes he can go to Uganda and do something, and he did. And so that's a positive. However, there, as you say, there is this challenge of not everybody can do that. There's not a role for everyone who wants to start an organization or start a business in our society. And there's always going to be a need for some people to do really, you know, regular work. And so there is some concern there. And I think part of what you see is people feeling like, I'm not living up to what I would like to be doing. I'm not fulfilling my potential. I could be doing, you know, more than this. But I think over time that will perhaps, at least on the business side, that will self-correct itself through sort of, you know, businesses will fail and, you know, people will be competing for, you know, funding and things like that. And they'll realize that they have to merge with another company and they have to do that kind of work. And I think on the employee side, one of the things that's actually happening is, you know, employers are starting to embrace pieces of that, some of them, and make the companies, you know, have some commitment to social responsibility, to, you know, engagement, to volunteerism, things like that. So this is incidentally one of the first questions millennials ask recruiters is, what's your commitment to social responsibility? What's your, you know, do you have a volunteer, you know, policy at this company? So it's actually interesting. You've really never been a generation of people who've been, you know, actually changing things. Again, another example of this sort of more quiet activism that we may not even realize is activism, of changing companies through being employees. So more and more companies are having to adopt things like that in order to retain talent, because people are always going to need young people because they work hard and long and they're cheap. So, okay.
And then when he was a senior, the interviews he had, one of the companies that offered him a job, it was a six-figure salary, and he turned it down and started working with a startup because he said, I'd leave in 2 years because I'd just be a cog in the wheel. I can do something creative in this company. They're both IT jobs. They're tech jobs. It's a software developer. And at the time, I thought, well, first, I was sort of like, mixed emotions, happy for him and concerned about my own circumstance that he was 21 and getting offered a six-figure salary. But my thought was, how could he be that grounded, that young? And while I don't discount that he's one of the most unique people I know. I'm feeling sort of gratified that he's a representative of the generation, because I think it's amazing that he's like that. I'm so impressed by him, and I think it's great that it's, like I said, that it's more representative than just this unique outlier that's who he is.
Yeah.
You know, that he's influenced by all the things you talked about. It's fascinating.
I think that's absolutely, I mean, it's great to hear that, and I think that's, you know, there are tons of stories like that out there, and I think, you know, for people who are skeptical that these are sort of these isolated cases, you know, that may not be the norm, but it's no longer, you know, merely the exception. And I think that's very encouraging. There are people who are turning down, you know, great jobs, you know, that pay them a lot of money because to go do other work because they feel like, you know, that's more valuable to them, or they're going to have a better experience there, you know, or whatever their reason. That's new. I mean, people have not been turning down, you know, six-figure job offers in such large numbers. And I think that's a positive. Again, it all goes back to sort of a shift in values and a shift away from, you know, one of the things I'm working on thinking about now is this idea of social entrepreneurship and how it's grown, and this idea of what does sort of the next generation economy look like, in which people are not, you know, all solely motivated purely by profit. This is not to say that people are not motivated by profit, or that they're, you know, purely motivated by passion and idealism, but there's definitely a shift away from that being the number one driver as this generation starts to take a more powerful place in the economy. Absolutely. So thank you all. I know some people have some questions. Please stick around. I'll be happy to answer them one-on-one. And thank you again for coming. If you want more information about the book or me, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at David Burstein. And the website is fastfuturebook.com. And again, thank you all so much for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.